From Utah Public Radio, this is Undisciplined. I'm Reagan Edelman. Most humans have, at the very least, a basic idea of the natural world and an understanding of the fundamentals. We know the differences between predators and prey, for example, and can tell the difference between certain species. We can recognize different ecosystems and that there are different adaptations needed to thrive in each. But there's a disconnect between the natural world that the majority of us know and accept and the natural world that thrives in the nighttime hours. In fact, many people have a natural urge to see the animals that come out at night as inherently worse, scarier, grosser, or more dangerous than their daytime counterparts, the moth and the butterfly, for example. But if we set aside our distrust of what comes out at night, you will find yourself stunned by the rich, beautiful, and fascinating world that nighttime nature has to offer. And in a new book, that's exactly what Charles Hood does. Charles is a poet, essayist, photographer, field guide author, and a professor emeritus, and he is recently the author of Nature at Night, Discover the Hidden World That Comes Alive After Dark, which is set to release on April 29th. The book is an exploration of what he calls the least studied, least photographed, and least appreciated segment of our planet's nonstop 24-hour go-go show. Charles Hood, welcome.
Hey, thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be with you today.
Charles, you have a crazy collection of stories and experiences, and much of your adult life has been spent traveling and learning about the natural world. You describe yourself as an addict of ecosystems. Have you always been that way? Do you remember a time where you weren't an eco-addict?
You know, it's strange when we look back on how we became who we became, if that makes any sense. I'm sure many of your listeners have had this experience where you realize, oh, gee, there were personality traits manifesting themselves early on. And so I was lucky that when I was younger, there wasn't much supervision of children, not the way there is now. And so once I got a bicycle, pretty much that was it. My parents had no idea where I was, and that would make two of us, because sometimes I didn't know where I was either. I grew up in East LA, and I just basically would ride as far as I could, you know, in a 2 or 3 hour radius. And that's manifested, I guess, you know, these days as we have credit cards that I can get on an airplane and go wherever I want. Whether I can pay for that credit card or not, I won't always vouch, you know, but I get to get on a plane and just go places. And I don't know, I haven't lost that thrill. It just seems so fun.
You have a interesting learning trajectory in the sense that you are largely self-taught. Can you tell me a little bit about your learning process and how you got to the point that you are now?
I really want to encourage our listeners. You know, I dropped out of college 9 times, and it's just, I went back and forth. I was married young and had to work to support myself. So I'd work in a factory or I'd have whatever job I had. And it was usually kind of stinky, to be honest. And so I'd go to school for a while, and then I'd run out of money and I'd drop out for a while. And I was really kind of lucky in that I ended up in a tenure track job, but it almost was an accident. And so that I've got a pension, like on my own, I was kind of bungling it, but luckily I walked into this job and that job has allowed me a little bit of freedom. I'm a professor emeritus of English. I never got to teach biology in any formal kind of way. But one of the things about, I don't really see the classroom as needing to take place in the classroom. And then we can have lots of experiences in other kinds of spaces. And so even if we're walking across campus because we've decided to leave the classroom, or we're going to go meet in the library, or we're going to go meet in the theater, wherever we're on our way to, there's no reason not to stop and do a little tour of the trees and what's in the trees. So I knew where all the owls roosted on my campus, and I could usually find them most days. And I was really amazed at some of the people's kind of surprised and at times frightened responses. I remember one student saying, oh, but it's looking at me. Like, well, yes, of course it's looking down at you. That doesn't mean it plans to harm you. And that's one of the things that I realized is that people really have misperceptions of nature. And those of us who have a little more fluency and a little more freedom of movement, shall we say, can share with the others maybe permission to be out in nature more than they might normally feel they can be.
It seems that nature and writing and English has been intertwined for much of your life, much of your adult life, and your love for poetry and literature is pretty evident in all of your writing. I read somewhere that you have a collection of about 5,000 books. That's like my dream. Is that true?
Oh, that's a low end estimate, and that includes the fact that I finally got rid of my poetry library, so I got rid of about 1,200 books couple of years ago. And for your listeners who think that's a lot of books, it, you know, books come into your life. But the main thing that that number means is that I have some stability in my living environment. And if you are moving often, or if you're a student and you're in a smaller kind of space, obviously you don't have that kind of luxury to have such a book collection.
You have done a little bit of everything, it seems. You've been a ski instructor, a bird guide in Africa, an artist in residence with the National Science Foundation in Antarctica, which is crazy, a factory worker, and you've traveled all over the place. When you were a little Charles, could you have ever imagined all of the amazing, wonderful, and bizarre experiences that you've had now?
No, and I'll be, again, I want to be upfront with our listeners. I was actually living in my car when I started graduate school. And on one hand, I can say I went to a great graduate school, and I did. And I actually studied with Louise Glück, the late poet, who later received the Nobel Prize in Literature. So I really was with some really amazing people. But I was coming from a place of, you know, if I can be blunt about it, you know, I was fairly poor, pretty seriously poor some days. And so the idea that these sorts of opportunities would later manifest themselves was really a surprise to me. But I'll tell everybody, fill out the piece of paper. You never know. They may send you somewhere. So it started with me applying to be a Fulbright scholar. And I wanted to go to Papua New Guinea because I wanted to see the animals and the birds, you know, and the cultures. And I couldn't afford to go to Papua New Guinea on my own. So like, well, maybe someone else will fill me, send me there. Maybe I just fill out this little form and see what happens. And that has been true for a number of experiences, including going to the South Pole with the National Science Foundation. In Antarctica, it overlapped with the teaching semester. Some of you are on the academic, you know, grid still, or you recently were, and you know, your life is, you know, determined by start and stop dates. And that was true for me as well as an employee. So I'm in Antarctica and I'm supposed to be teaching. So I have to teach online, you know, this is before the pandemic. And then when the pandemic came, I was good at it, which certainly made it a lot less stressful for me. Some of my colleagues had never Zoomed once in their life.
Speaking of pandemics, I want to hear about one of your crazy stories that literally made my jaw fall open. You had a bit of a run-in with the bubonic plague.
Oh, sure. You know, it's still out in the, you know, and now the bubonic plague that really wiped out Western Europe in the Middle Ages, that has mutated for the most part. So it's no longer quite as virulent as it used to be, number one. Number two, we have antibiotics. Hello, medicine. So what happened is I was looking for prairie chickens and I had to sneak up on them. And I crawled through the prairie dog mounds in Oklahoma to see the prairie chickens. It did not see the prairie chickens, by the way, but I was trying. And in that encounter with the dirt, I encountered the mounds of the prairie dogs, which meant I encountered the fleas of the prairie dogs. And here's why our listeners want to have a good classical education. There I am camping in northern New Mexico when the disease began to develop in my body. But I had read a book called A Distant Mirror about the bubonic plague in the Middle Ages. And I knew the warning signs that, oh, my buboes are swelling up. This is not a good thing. And I was just in contact with rodents. I should think about what this means. So I was able to get out of out on this dirt road and get, you know, down to the ER room down in, must have been Albuquerque, I went to, probably was the closest one.
It was the beginning of the 5,000 book collection.
Yes, right. Yes. Always. And read everything and remember what you read. Yes.
Charles, let's get into your most recent book, Nature at Night. I want to start by saying that this is awesome. This book is both beautiful and fascinating. And part of the reason it's so effective, I think, is because of the incredible photography that you include on almost every single page. And most of this photography is yours.
Well, I'm holding the book up to the microphone. I want everyone in all the listeners to be able to really get a good view of it. So I'm rubbing it right up against the microphone.
It's beautiful.
Yes. Well, thank you. Thank you. You're very kind. Thank you very much. Doing Nature at Night, I really had a goal of not doing deer in the headlights. And obviously, for some animals, we need a flash to light them up. But there's ways to mute that flash, just like a mute on a trombone or something. And so when you do a fashion shoot with a fashion model, the light is wrapped around the model by using various shapers and diffusers and so on. And my question was, well, why aren't we doing, every time we look at a bat, because bats are easy to, you know, they get caught in nets and people study bats. And like, well, if we're studying the bats, why don't we use fashion lighting to give it kind of a soft wrapped light? And that'll make the animal more attractive to the people that maybe think bats are scary or bats are vampires or bats want to bite you or whatever their misperceptions are. let's use some visual storytelling here and let's borrow some techniques from other kinds of disciplines, to quote back to our program title today. And that is exactly what happened. So I'm in Peru with all these duffel bags of fashion, you know, fashion lighting equipment. And yes, it is a pain in the caboose. I gotta, you know, it'd be so much easier not to travel with a camera and then all the flashes, but then I wouldn't get the images that I want. And I really do think that images, particularly these days, really do tell the story as effectively or more effectively than words tell the story. I kind of hate to admit it, but we are a very visually saturated culture. And if you're trying to make nature, you really have to compete with these other kinds of image generating machines that are out there. And your book better look pretty sharp or people are not going to really believe in it or accept it as much as they should.
I think that the imagery in the photographs and the imagery and the words that you use go very well together in this book. One of my favorite photos is a image you took of a rhinoceros chameleon. And as you're describing this process, you say something about how he did not want his picture taken, but like, don't worry, we're going to move on quick, friend, or something like that. And I just think it's so fun. It feels like the reader is there with you as you're exploring these different ecosystems.
It is true. You can tell from the animal when you're getting a little bit too close or they're really kind of grumping at you. And the question is, okay, am I being too disrespectful and it's just time to give up on this project? Or can I, you know, wrap it up another 20, 30 seconds, whatever it's going to take, and get that last great shot and then move on? So yes, in Madagascar, the rhinoceros chameleon, that was a good shot. And as I say in the book, we were probably 200 meters from the bar. Like, you don't have to, like, you know, get an entire expedition with porters and ropes and leeches and all this stuff. Like, you can actually do plenty of nature study just around the basic grounds of a park or your own backyard, for that matter.
You've studied birds, mammals, numerous different types of creatures, and your research has led you to travel to numerous countries and continents and all 50 states. What is it that drew you out into the night for this project?
I really believe what I'm about to tell your listeners, and that is that we miss out on half of nature if we think that nature is only a daytime kind of thing. And it's normal, you know, we're diurnal primates on average. But if we suddenly realize, well, wait, what is going on? Who is pollinating? You know, some of the plants are being pollinated at night. What's pollinating those plants at night? Or what are those lemurs doing? We're used to thinking of lemurs as, you know, something you see in the zoo, like the ring-tailed lemur or something. But there are plenty of nocturnal lemurs. There's more nocturnal lemurs than there are daytime lemurs. So I really was just curious, what's out there? What are the effective ways I can find out about them? And luckily, at the same time, LED flashlights are becoming better. Rechargeable batteries are becoming better. And collectively, I think we're really at kind of a dawn of a great age of exploration, that is easier to see animals at night than ever before, and that there are more opportunities and more places to go. And also, there are better websites now that we're sharing information. So you can, if you find something, you can share it with others.
You wrote that a part of the reason the night is underutilized, underappreciated in terms of wildlife and nature study is because for a long time it was associated with danger and immorality, which I think is true. The idea is still ingrained in my head. It's why I had a curfew growing up, and it's why I bring my pepper spray when I'm walking my dog at night. But this wasn't always the case. Tell me a little bit about the relationship that humans once had with the night.
It's just a simple historical reality that we wouldn't be here as species if we couldn't navigate at night. And it is true that lots of the great apes, they like to go to bed, you know, so they'll make a nest in the, you know, orangutans and gorillas, they make a nest. But it's also true when we get down into just the last even 500 years, if you couldn't walk around at night, you couldn't go from village to village, or you couldn't go home from your workplace, you know, in the winter, or from the fields in the winter to get back to the village. And that it's actually very easy to walk at night without a flashlight if you, A, stop being afraid and just don't think of it as a menacing place, and B, you let your eyes adjust. Even if you need glasses, even if you don't have the world's best, you know, 20/20 vision, you have eyes that see really, really well at night. And if the moon is up and it's a full moon, oh my gosh, the landscape's actually flooded with light. We simply have to give ourselves permission to spend that extra moment and adjust to it and utilize it.
I think the first thing that many people think of when they think of wildlife at night is just nocturnal animals, owls, bats that are able to navigate the night skies. But there's a lot more to it than just being awake at different hours. It's about unique adaptations and strong survival instincts.
Yes, and I think it's about us as humans acknowledging that the ecosystem has got more components to it than maybe we know about. And so even if we think, you know, something like the ocean, which is not that well studied, but partially well studied, there's this tremendous vertical migration going on in the ocean as all the things that eat plants, all the zooplankton that are going to eat the phytoplankton, come up out of the safe depths where they've spent the day to come to the first 100 meters of the water column close to the surface of the ocean. Phytoplankton are up there because that's where the light is, but animals don't want to be up there during the day because they feel like they're going to be predated. So they've been hanging out in the dark ocean, and then they have this vertical migration where they come up to the surface of the ocean. And technically, we could say it's the biggest migration on the planet, much bigger than caribou going across the Arctic, or, you know, the wildebeest going across the Serengeti or something like that. Trillions and trillions and trillions and trillions of organisms are moving up vertically during the day and, you know, at the end of the day, and then feeding at night and then going back, sinking back down. And so if we start to imagine ecosystems as having lots of components, some of those components are nocturnal. And until we allow ourselves to think about the night, we're going to be missing some of the obvious pieces of the puzzle, so to speak.
I was really excited that you included a segment on the ocean at night. I'm a huge ocean nerd. I think it's the school of wildlife I've always been the most drawn to. And it sometimes feels like a different world. So I think it's really easy to forget about it when doing projects such as this.
Yes, there's so many parts of our environment that I think that it were easy to forget that they exist. And so we're used to thinking of the rainforest or the, where I mentioned the Serengeti plains, you know, and that's not that the Serengeti doesn't exist. It's not that saying, you know, lions isn't a great thing to do, but there are other kinds of locations on the planet that really do deserve our attention and our affection, frankly. Why not? If we like seeing daytime animals at the zoo, everyone likes to see a zebra or a giraffe or something. Well, why not think about the bats in the Amazon that catch fish? I just think that's so cool. Bats that can catch a fish just by listening to the sound of the, you know, the dorsal fin, the little tiny fin on the top of the minnow breaking the surface of the water. And a bat can hear that with the echolocation and reach down and scoop it up in these great clawed, pouched feet that it has. So I just, why not have a zoo exhibit just about come at 2 p.m., we'll be feeding the fishing bats. Like, this is something that we don't do, but we perhaps could.
It's crazy. And I think night feeding especially is so fascinating. And it's kind of a give and take. A lot of the time, it's a predator and the prey deciding if it's worth it to take certain risks in order to night feed. Tell me a little bit about dolphins and the nocturnal squids.
Yeah, there's a great picture in the book that I took during the day, and it shows this series of kind of starfish-like marks on the side of a dolphin. And then when I did a little bit of research, I figured out, oh, I know what's going on here. So that I mentioned earlier, there was this vertical migration going from dark to, you know, from the depths of the dark ocean. Then at night, they're coming up to feed. And that means the squid are coming up, and that means that the dolphins are after the squid. But other things are ambushing the animals along the way. So there's a thing called a cookie cutter shark, and it's got kind of a circular mouth, roughly speaking, very, very serrated edges. And it has this great strategy, great for it anyway, and I think it's kind of cool. So it darts up against the side of a larger animal, like a dolphin, for example, and does sort of a hit. Like if you can imagine you were going to punch someone in the arm real quick, boom, you just punch them. So it comes up, it does a little punch. And in that punch, it takes its mouth and does a divot. It carves a little circular divot of flesh out of the dolphin and then just peels away. Before the dolphin can, you know, respond or bite it or swim past it, the cookie cutter shark peels away, and then it's got this great mouthful of food. And then that scar will heal. And as the daytime photography happens, so here's a rough-toothed dolphin in the book. It's leaping out of the water. I took its picture. The scars of the nighttime attacks are visible along its flanks. So there's something that we wouldn't normally think about dolphins. Oh, they must be happy, and they sort of jump and all these things. But really, they are jumping and being frolicsome, partly because they've been hunting all night, and they have extra energy during the day. Their hunting is when the squid are out, and the squid are out at night because they're following this vertical migration. But they're also then being predated by these little cookie-cutter sharks. So there we go. The circle of life, my friends, happening all around us day and night.
I think that one of the most visually stunning segments of this book is when you're discussing solar winds and the beauty of the Northern Lights. We actually had a Northern Light show a couple of months ago, and it was absolutely stunning. Tell me a little bit about this beautiful lighting of the night sky.
We want to encourage everybody, hey, you know, the solar maxima is not over. And so this coming winter, you know, the next coming winter after this winter winds down, there's still more solar displays yet to come, I predict. Utah's got some good skies coming up. My first aurora borealis, my first northern lights, was actually from an airplane. I was flying to Boston for work, and there was a great display looking out the airplane window. But yes, isn't that wonderful that we get to just look out at the sky and for free get to see this stuff that's happening, you know, way the heck up there, y'all. And we're looking up at these excited ions dancing around in the magnetic sphere. And yay for us. What a great planet.
Did you have a favorite segment of this book, a favorite research subject or area? I know that's a difficult question, but I'm just curious. Was there one thing that absolutely floored you that stuck out to you?
Yes, I have been blessed that I get to work with someone named Jose Gabriel. That's his first name, Jose Gabriel Martinez Fonseca. And he's a PhD bat researcher. He's from Nicaragua. He lives in Flagstaff now. And we do bats together. And so he's got the technical expertise, but also the legal permits for us to handle bats. And so we've been able to, he's photographed now 225 species of bats. And he's been a very good mentor to me in my bat photography and just being a fun companion. So I'll tell a quick story. I hope this fits in our broadcast. So we're catching bats in Nicaragua, and we catch a vampire bat, and it bites Jose, but their teeth are sharp as scalpels. They're just astounding little, and they have an anticoagulant in their saliva. So his little nick on his thumb wouldn't heal, and he's bleeding. The blood is, you know, flowing down his arm. And he threw the bat down, as one does. He's just been bitten by the vampire. He throws it down. And it didn't fly away. That's the fun thing, is it scuttled away. They're actually runners. When they come up to, when a vampire is coming up on a pig or a tapir to, you know, bite it on the haunch and get it, lick up the blood, it actually approaches on the ground. It flies close and lands and then approaches on the ground. And so when this one wanted to get away, it ran away rather than flying away. But poor Jose, because of the anticoagulant, he actually bled for about an hour. The next bat we were handling was a big fruit bat, and I noticed in the photographs that it's got blood on the wings, and it's not that they hurt the bat. It's that poor Jose was still bleeding from his vampire bat wound, and it was getting on the next animal.
That's so interesting. A lot of this book is about connection. It's that circle of life we've been talking about, and it's also about our connection to the world around us. Tell me a little bit about the way your connection with the natural world developed as you were working on this book.
I know I'm still learning. I mentioned earlier that, you know, for my professional life, I am an English teacher, and I know a little bit about literature and poetry and all that kind of stuff. But I'm still learning about nature. And if anything that motivates me to go out, whether it's a question about where, how to photograph something, or where are the boundaries of this animal, you know, where it's its range, there's a lot to be learned still, and particularly about animals at night. And this is where your listeners can help us out. Go out, see it, post it, write about it, enjoy it, and expand our circle of knowledge.
You close the book with a really beautiful line, I think. You say, "The night is annoying, frightening, impossible, and yet, it is also so full of beauty that I know I will never get enough of it." Tell me a little bit about that feeling as you're coming to a close on this story, on this amazing chapter of life.
The book ends with a "you are there" kind of walk through the rainforest. I actually happened to be in Panama for that section, walking from a place called Canopy Tower. Some of your listeners have been there, perhaps to go birdwatching. So walking down the road through the rainforest from Canopy Tower and trying to show what you would actually see, frogs and snakes and nightjars and things on the way down. But there's no, this sounds fake or insincere. I honestly was full of joy. It was a miraculous night. I actually collated a couple different walks into one narrative, but it really is great to be out in nature. It really is fun and sexy and exciting and maddening. I don't like mosquitoes. Nobody does. So it is true. It is frustrating. And I don't like being sweaty. Oh my gosh. It's so sweaty in the rainforest. I wish it was dry like the desert, but it ain't. So I got to deal with it. And so that joy may seem like a rhetorical trick, but it's also coming from a place of sincerity. We really do live surrounded by beauty, and we need to remind ourselves of that and not let politics and not let environmental news steal away the fact that there is beauty, and it's doing a pretty good job of carrying on day after day, night after night.
That's Charles Hood. He is many things, some of which include a naturalist, a poet, a photographer, and an author. And he is most recently the author of Nature at Night, Discover the Hidden World That Comes Alive After Dark, which is set to release on April 29th. Charles, thank you so much.
Thank you. This was really fun.
Undisciplined is a production of Utah Public Radio, and if you happen to live in Utah, you can listen to us on UPR every Thursday morning at 10:30. If you miss us then, you can listen to every episode of Undisciplined wherever you get your podcasts. Our program is supported by the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University and from listeners like you. You can support our work at donate.nprstations.org/UPR. Our executive producer is Matthew LaPont. Our theme music is Little Idea by Benjamin Tissot, and I'm Reagan Edelman. Thanks for listening. Now go have big ideas.